Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Thursday, July 23rd, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakrose. 21 current hospitalizations from COVID-19 in Cerro Gordo County. The information that Mason City Mayor Bill Schickel shared at the top of Wednesday afternoon's press conference was a sobering reminder that the COVID-19 pandemic is still ongoing. Schickel pointed out that in addition to reported positive cases going up by more than 100 in the past week, from 347 to 457, 21 people are currently hospitalized from the virus, with 2 in intensive care. And in the past week plus, numbers have come in that show the death toll from COVID in Cerro Gordo County has gone from 1 to 14, with one of those deaths being reported yesterday. With all of that, Schickel did point to a slight silver lining. On the brighter side, only one new case was reported yesterday. As the pandemic isn't going to fully disappear anytime soon, officials across the city have had to adapt. That's no different for the Mason City Community School District, which is why Schickel had Superintendent Dave Versteeg on to discuss fall planning. According to Versteeg, the district, like others throughout the state, has 3 components to its learning plan for the fall semester: in-person learning, continuous learning such as online or remote learning, and some kind of hybrid of the two. Based on surveying that the district has done, Versteeg said that about 30% of district families are interested in going the continuous learning route. For kids coming back to school, Versteeg made it clear that the district is doing a whole host of things to keep students and staff safe. That includes new visitor procedures so that people can't just come and go as they please, new cleaning procedures, disabling drinking fountains, no large indoor group meetings, maintaining social distancing in and out of the classroom, and encouraging everyone to wear masks. "We know our parents and employers all want school to open, and so do we," Versteeg said. "As a community, these decisions we make have an impact about the start of school on August 24th. Both Versteeg and Schickel emphasized that one of the best ways to return on time and maintain is for people to wear masks. Schickel pointed out at the top of the meeting that the city is mandating face coverings at all public buildings, and then he asked all residents to wear masks in all other locations when possible. "I've been very happy with that," Schickel said of the city mandate. "People are complying with that." As of now, Mercy One North Iowa has said its staff is currently collecting specimens for 200 to 250 tests each day from people in the community who meet the testing criteria for COVID-19. The current positive test rate for the county has been circling around 6%. With the volume of tests being processed, Mercy One noted in a press release from Cerro Gordo County Public Health that while most results return within 3 to 4 days, it will occasionally take up to 7 days if volumes at the State of Iowa Hygienic Lab are high. Iowa sees confirmed virus cases nearly double in 1 day. The latest coronavirus figures in Iowa show the number of confirmed cases nearly doubled in the 24-hour period from Wednesday morning to Thursday, pushing the state's total to more than 40,500. The state health department's virus tracking site showed that as of 10 a.m. Thursday, there had been 716 cases confirmed from the day before, when 374 cases were confirmed. The state also reported 7 more deaths from COVID-19, the disease caused by the virus. That brought Iowa's total to 815 since the beginning of the outbreak. Hospitalizations for the virus also continued to creep upward, with 232 people hospitalized for the virus by Thursday morning. That's higher than what had been seen in recent weeks, but still far lower than the state's peak of 417 on May 6th. Iowa hospitals also showed slight drops in space and equipment available to treat the outbreak and other maladies. The online tracker showed 38% of the state's hospital beds available and 79% of its 790 ventilators available on Thursday. Iowa sees fewest unemployment claims since March. Iowans filed for more than 126,000 unemployment claims between July 12th and July 18th, Iowa Workforce Development said Thursday morning, marking the fewest total claims in the state since the week of March 22nd. New totals accounted for 9,505 claims, a decrease from 10,653 the previous week. Continuing claims accounted for 116,810, a decline from 134,284 the previous week. While 1 week is not a trend, it is the biggest decline in continuing claims we have had in a single week since the beginning of the pandemic, Beth Townsend, Director of Iowa Workforce Development, said in a statement. We hope we continue to see similar declines in coming weeks as more and more Iowans return to work. Manufacturing remains the largest source of claims with 2,085, followed by self-employed and independent contractors with 1,703, healthcare and social assistance with 864, retail trade with 599, and food services with 596. Thursday's announcement marks the fewest claims in manufacturing since the week of June 14th. The claims resulted in $31.8 million in standard unemployment benefits, $85.6 million in federal pandemic unemployment compensation, $5.9 million in pandemic unemployment assistance, and $3.5 million in pandemic emergency unemployment compensation. The FPUC benefits expire this week, meaning Iowans no longer will receive the additional $600 per week in federal benefits. So far, the federal government has issued $1.4 billion in FPUC payouts to Iowans. The drop in Iowa's unemployment claims came as national initial claims increased to 1.4 million last week, snapping a streak of 15 weeks with initial claims decreasing. These numbers only show who is actively seeking work and therefore do not give a full accounting of how many people are out of work. Half of Iowa casinos requiring face masks. More than half of Iowa's 23 casinos are requiring guests to wear face masks while inside the casino. According to an analysis of the casino's coronavirus-related policies posted on their websites, 12 casinos are now requiring all guests to wear face masks inside the casinos. Some of the requirements say the mask mandate is in effect whenever guests are within 6 feet of each other. Another 11 casinos are not requiring face masks, but saying they are encouraging or recommending guests wear them. Some casinos are providing masks to guests who do not arrive with one. Public health and infectious disease experts, as well as some early studies, say wearing face masks helps prevent the spread of the new coronavirus and COVID-19, the disease the virus causes. As of Wednesday afternoon, nearly 40,000 Iowans had contracted the coronavirus at some point during the global pandemic, and 808 Iowans had died of COVID-19. Those kinds of efforts and initiatives are evolving constantly and should be, said Wes Ehrke, president and CEO of the Iowa Gaming Association, which represents 19 casinos across the state. I believe we're trying to provide that entertainment experience in as accommodating but also responsible a fashion as possible. The casinos that are requiring guests to wear face masks, according to their policies posted online, are Grand Falls Casino and Golf Resort in Larchwood, Harrah's and Horseshoe Casinos in Council Bluffs, Isle Casino Hotels in Bettendorf and Waterloo, Prairie Flower Casino in Carter Lake, Prairie Meadows in Altoona, Rhythm City Casino Resort in Davenport, Riverside Casino and Golf Resort in Riverside, Meskwaki Bingo Casino in Tama, Blackbird Bend Casino in Onawa, and Winna Vegas Casino Resort in Sloan. The casinos that are not requiring masks but are encouraging or recommending that guests wear them are Ameristar Casino Hotel in Council Bluffs, Casino Queen in Marquette, Catfish Bend Casino in Burlington, Diamond Joe Casinos in Dubuque and Northwood, Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Sioux City, Lakeside Hotel Casino in Osceola, Q Casino in Dubuque, and the Wild Rose Casinos in Clinton, Emmitsburg, and Jefferson. Each casino also has other virus-related policies and practices. Most are requiring workers to wear masks, and many are employing other social distancing measures and frequently sanitizing gaming areas. I think the overriding thing here is that every casino has put in extensive protocols and procedures for the safety of their patrons and of their staff, Ehrke said. Four casinos, Blackbird Bend, Winnevegas, Meskwaki, and Prairie Flower have taken the extra step of also banning smoking, according to the American Lung Association. Those four casinos are not governed by state regulations. State-regulated casinos are exempt from the state's smoke-free law. We applaud the decision of the owners of these four casinos for adopting a smoke-free workplace policy as they reopen after COVID-19 forced businesses to shut their doors, American Lung Association Advocacy Director Christina Hamilton said in a news release. This policy will protect the health of workers and customers from dangerous secondhand smoke and e-cigarette emissions, and we call for the permanent adoption of this policy. Grassley welcomes Trump's resumption of COVID-19 briefings. President Donald Trump's resumption of coronavirus briefings is, quite frankly, a breath of fresh air, according to Senator Chuck Grassley. The American people just need to be leveled with, the Iowa Republican said Wednesday about the president's Tuesday afternoon briefing on the pandemic. I think he's kind of doing that when he's finally admitting that whether you want to wear a mask or not, I don't want to wear one, but I do, he tells people to wear a mask and that this thing could get worse before it gets better. The briefings, which Trump said would continue on a daily basis, are very healthy for any president, Grassley told reporters. As for Congress acting on a fourth round of pandemic relief, Grassley said members knew 6 weeks ago it was likely another round of assistance would be necessary, but wanted to see if efforts to control the spread of COVID-19 were successful and whether the economy was rebounding. There's a whole mess of ideas floating out there, including some of Chuck Grassley's ideas of what Congress should put in the package, he said. One of Grassley's priorities is to include his proposal to limit increases in prescription drug prices to no more than the change in the consumer price index. That would be 2% this year, he said. Action now is important because the price of medicine is both a health issue and a pocketbook issue, Grassley said. As Finance Committee Chairman, Grassley will be involved in discussions about supplemental unemployment benefits, support for rural health care, and tax relief. The supplemental jobless benefits will continue, but not at the current $600 a week, he said. At $600 a week, the federal government is creating unfair competition for small businesses trying to get employees back to work. He's not a big fan of the payroll tax cut because it might be October before it's implemented. If people get $30 or $40 more in their paychecks, they might not notice it, especially if they are working irregular hours or overtime because of the pandemic. If there's a payroll tax cut, Congress would have to use income tax revenue to replace Social Security payroll taxes, Grassley said. However, if people get a second direct stimulus payment, they're more likely to notice that and spend it, he said. Even if it's something less than $1,200 to the same people again, most of them are probably going to spend it, and if they don't spend it, they are at least going to know they're getting it, he said. Grassley emphasized that it's early days in the discussion. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wants to cap the fourth phase relief package at $1 trillion, so you kind of have a zero-sum game because whatever spending is added has to be offset somewhere else in the deal. The U.S. House in May passed an additional $3 trillion stimulus package, which includes aid to state and local governments socked with coronavirus expenses. Trump has said he would veto that measure, preferring the $1 trillion target the Senate is pursuing. Clear Lake's H. Milton Duesenberg retires. The city of Clear Lake honored H. Milton Duesenberg earlier this week. Duesenberg, archivist at Clear Lake Public Library, has retired. Clear Lake Mayor Nelson Crabb read a proclamation recognizing Duesenberg's dedication and commitment to the community and congratulating him on his retirement Monday evening during the council meeting. Duesenberg began working at the library on October 18, 2005, in the History Room. During his 14 years of service, he worked to preserve valuable collections of Clear Lake history by evaluating, retrieving, and arranging materials, answering hundreds of inquiries, storing and preserving perishable documents, promoting Clear Lake history through programs and presentations to the community, negotiating the acquisition of new collections, and making the archives accessible to everyone, the proclamation states. Duesenberg was named the Grand Marshal for the 4th of July parade in 2015. Well done, H., Crabb said. Thank you. Larry Wentz III wins GOP nomination for Cerro Gordo County Recorder. The race to fill the open seat for Cerro Gordo County Recorder is now essentially set. On Tuesday night, Larry Wentz III beat out Cerro Gordo County Deputy Treasurer Thomas Chauvin for the GOP nomination for Recorder. With that, the current Rockwell City Council member will face off against current County Recorder Assistant Anne Marie Legler, who is the lone Democratic candidate vying for the job. When Wentz III declared in early July, he pointed to his admiration of North Iowa as part of his reason for running, and also singled out the work he's done both privately and publicly for the community. As for Legler, she has written that she constantly strives to ensure accuracy and consistency in all aspects of her duties in her current work with the County Recorder's Office. The position came open when Colleen Pierce, who had been in the job for 30 years, retired on June 30th. At one point, there were four candidates competing for the recorder job, but one person, Steve Meinert, withdrew before the nominating process. Clear Lake offers early retirement packages to employees. Three Clear Lake employees have opted to participate in the city's new early retirement incentive program. Paul Chizik, Linda Nelson, and Joe Weigel will retire before September 30th and partake in the program, Clear Lake City Administrator Scott Flory told the City Council Monday evening. It will be difficult, to say the least, daunting for sure, to replace all three of these folks, he said. Chizik, a Clear Lake police lieutenant, has been with the city for 32 years. Nelson, city finance director, has been with the city for nearly 31 years, and Weigel, public works director, has been with the city for about 31 and a half years. They are participating in the voluntary retirement incentive program the city council approved earlier this month. The program assists eligible city employees who wish to retire but can't due to health insurance coverage concerns. To be eligible for the voluntary program, participants must be currently employed in a benefited full-time or full-time equivalent position with the city of Clear Lake, must be 56 or older upon their retirement from the city, must have no less than 25 years of continuous employment with the city. Under the program, eligible employees who are 60 will be able to remain on the city's group health insurance plan under a single policy for up to 5 years, but in no case past 65 years old or when Medicare eligible. Participating employees may choose to continue family health insurance coverage by paying for the difference between the cost of a family coverage premium and the city's contribution toward a single coverage premium. City employees who retire before 60 years old can use post-retirement accumulated paid leave conversion credit to pay their health insurance premiums. However, if the credit is insufficient to cover the premium to age 60, the employees are responsible for paying them. The post-retirement accumulated paid leave conversion credit allows eligible full-time city employees to convert accumulated paid leave hours, including sick, vacation, personal, and comp time, to a dollar-based credit to pay premiums for coverage under the city's group health insurance program, the resolution states. Under the program, eligible employees must retire from employment with the city between August 1st and September 30th. Chizik will retire in August, and Nelson and Weigel will leave in September, Flory said. Notice of intent to retire under the program needed to be filed with Flory before July 17th. Iowa cites quality concerns for cuts at Dubuque testing site. An aide to Governor Kim Reynolds said Wednesday that concerns with the quality and safety of coronavirus testing at a busy clinic in Dubuque prompted the state to sharply reduce its operations this week. The state will send 2,000 additional kits to Dubuque County to make additional testing available to residents at other area clinics to fill the gap, said Reynolds Communications Director Pat Garrett. Dubuque announced Monday that the governor's office had ordered that testing at the Epic Health and Wellness Clinic be open only from 6 a.m. to 7 a.m. Tuesday through Thursday and take no more than 100 samples per day. The site, part of the governor's $26 million Test Iowa program, had been processing up to 550 samples per day and had long lines at times in recent weeks. Dubuque said it had received no explanation for the changes. Garrett had said Monday and Tuesday only that the changes were requested to align their process with other sites across the state and did not elaborate. Democratic lawmakers representing Dubuque at the state and federal levels reacted with outrage and questioned whether the Republican governor was deliberately trying to limit testing in a hot spot to keep case counts down. Garrett denied that claim. On Wednesday, he said the state had concerns with the quality of operations at the site and ordered that it be limited to 100 tests per day to focus on ensuring safety protocols and quality of the test procedure. Garrett said the county health department will make the 2,000 new test kits available to other clinics. The state of Iowa is continuing to scale up COVID-19 testing capacity as we continue to combat the pandemic, he said. City and county officials had previously said they were unaware of any quality concerns at the clinic, which didn't return a message seeking comment. Democratic lawmaker spoke with another Reynolds aide by phone Wednesday and said she cited lines that could take up to 3 hours at the clinic as one of the state's concerns. Dubuque County has seen more than 1,250 confirmed cases since the beginning of the pandemic and 24 deaths, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. State Representative Lindsey James, a Democrat from Dubuque, said she was able to get tested at the Epic Clinic in June within 30 minutes, but that wait times had increased in July. She said she did not hear a valid excuse for the cutbacks in testing from the governor's aide. The response of the governor should have been, "We will send you more staff and more resources and more tests." That's the appropriate response in the middle of a pandemic, she said. Not, oh, you have long wait times? Well, we're going to pull that back. That was one excuse among others. State Senator Pam Jochim, Democrat from Dubuque, said in a text message that other clinics and hotspots around the state also have long lines for testing. She said speculation about the governor's motivation for cutting testing would continue since they just pulled the rug out from under us without good reason. FBI announces $10,000 reward for info on missing Iowa girl. The FBI has raised to $10,000 the reward for information related to the disappearance of a 10-year-old Iowa girl who went missing earlier this month, an official said Wednesday. Christy Johnson, the special agent in charge of the FBI's office in Omaha, said that agents from around the country were searching for 10-year-old Breasia Terrell of Davenport. The number one goal is to find the person who is responsible for the disappearance of Breasia and bring that person to justice, Johnson said at a news conference. Terrell was reported missing July 10th after going to spend the previous night at an apartment with her half-brother and his father, 47-year-old Henry Dinkins. Investigators have called Dinkins a person of interest, and Davenport Police Chief Paul Sikorsky said Wednesday that he remained the main focus of the investigation. Dinkins is a registered sex offender stemming from a 1990 sexual abuse conviction when he was 17. He has been jailed without bond on a complaint alleging he violated the terms of his parole by failing to report the apartment address to authorities and having contact with minors. Johnson said investigators need any and all additional information and tips, and that's why the FBI added $6,500 to the previous reward. Council Bluffs Nursing Home acknowledges 6 residents died. A Council Bluffs nursing home has acknowledged a coronavirus outbreak at its facility that has left 6 residents dead. Risen Sun Christian Village told news organizations this week that 6 of its residents had died from COVID-19 since the facility reported its first case on June 26th. Risen Sun said 21 other residents and 13 employees also have been infected with the virus. The facility said it has dedicated units for infection control and is not allowing infected employees to come back to work until they are cleared by the health department. But one woman who learned Wednesday that her 96-year-old aunt died at Risen Sun this week said facility officials had not been forthcoming with the families of residents about its outbreak until it was contacted by reporters earlier this week, Omaha, Nebraska television station KETV reported. Only after that contact did the facility start providing text message updates to families, Cindy Bussey said. Bussey said she learned last week that her aunt, Katie Jacobs, had become infected and said her health deteriorated over the following days. "I asked to come into the building because she looked like she was dying, and they said, 'No, I'm sorry, she's stable,' Bussey said. On Wednesday, the facility called to inform her that Jacobs had died. Authorities identify man killed in Northwest Iowa grain bin. Authorities on Thursday identified a man who died after becoming trapped in a grain bin in northwest Iowa. The Plymouth County Sheriff's Office said Daniel Cronin, 65, died Tuesday after becoming trapped in a bin located about 5 miles east of Lamar's. Deputies and other first responders were called Tuesday morning to the grain bin for a report of a man trapped, officials said. Investigators determined Cronin had been loosening stuck corn when the crust broke and he sank into the grain. The accident happened despite the use of safety measures, officials said. Cronin had died by the time his body was recovered about an hour after rescuers arrived, officials said. Quad City estate sales remain a treasure hunt, even during a pandemic. In spite of COVID-19 and the politics surrounding the guidelines to stop its spread, estate sale hosts and goers are rolling with the punches and working to establish a new normal. "It's very challenging," said Jennifer Goldsberry of Bettendorf, who owns Doodads in Davenport, which hosts more than 90 estate sales a year around the Quad Cities. In March, Goldsberry began limiting the number of shoppers at a sale at once, recommending shoppers wear face coverings and providing hand sanitizer. Then, Illinois issued a stay-at-home order, and Iowa, while not fully doing so, closed non-essential businesses, including Doodads. Goldsberry was under a time crunch, booked with clients whose closing dates were approaching. So she moved the sales to Facebook Live. Items and lots were assigned numbers, and Goldsberry and her staff would move from item to item and box to box, describing items to viewers who could claim whatever they liked in real time. No contact pickup was arranged to retrieve purchases. "I was so incredibly honored," Goldsberry said. "The encouragement in attendance and the results that we got from that, I am so lucky to have such a tremendous following." Goldsberry worked out glitches as she went, and each virtual sale got a little easier. "It was a dream," she said. "We were so grateful to be able to work during those times when nobody else could work." As an added bonus, Goldsberry said, "So many people were messaging me, telling me the virtual sales made them feel normal again for a moment. That was beyond flattering." In pre-COVID times, Liz Nolte of Rock Island was known for heading to sales in the wee hours of the morning to secure her chance at highly sought-after items. "Half the fun is seeing everything all at once and getting an inside look at the homes, too," she said. "There's an excitement and energy about estate sales and getting up early to get a good number to take part." Nolte has been thankful for virtual sales. "Virtual sales really had a perk, and it was a different kind of fun energy," she said. Jennifer did an amazing job going item by item. "You had to be quick, though, and hope your Wi-Fi was faster than everyone else's if you really wanted to purchase something," she said. "It was a safe, fun alternative to have and still treasure hunt." As Iowa and Illinois began to reopen, Goldsberry hosted some sales by appointment only. This was challenging as many customers wanted to shop at the same times and some needed to reschedule. As states reopened further, Goldsberry followed federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines. Staff controls how many people shop at once to allow for social distancing. Shoppers enter through one door and exit through another and are asked to socially distance and be mindful of how many objects they are touching. Hand sanitizer is provided, and commonly touched items are sanitized throughout the sales, Goldsberry said. Customers bag up their own purchases to limit excessive handling, and Doodads requests that all shoppers wear face masks or facial coverings. "Doodads prefers customers wear masks," she said. "It might not be a popular preference, but it seems to be what everybody is gravitating toward." Goldsberry said about 80% of shoppers wear masks, even at outdoor sales. "We just want everybody to be respectful and just be courteous," she said. Dan Versha and his wife, Jennifer, of Rock Island, hosted an estate sale for his mother last month in Coal Valley and had the same rules. "We followed the Illinois governor's social distancing recommendations," Versha said. "Out of roughly 275 attendees, we only had one person walk away when we asked her to wear a mask. It was definitely strange, but everyone was pretty understanding," he said. "I definitely have a preference for other thrifters maintaining social distancing, wearing masks," thrift shopper Sarah Johnson of East Moline said. "Thrifting is the only hobby I have that is affordable to me, so I was excited when sales started back up. I feel, personally, that it's safer than stores at the moment." Johnson said estate sale shopping with masks and other recommended guidelines isn't weird at all. "It's about the same experience." If a sale is more crowded than she'd like, she browses areas with fewer people until things clear out. Faced with uncertainty for the future, Goldsberry plans to keep chugging along and adapt as needed. "We're operating in the safest capacity as possible," she said. "We invite everybody to come out at a distance." You're listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Thursday, July 23rd, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Bonnie M. Rodding, 1946 to 2020. Bonnie M. Rodding, 73, of Mason City, passed away on Sunday, July 19th, at her daughter's home in Cedar Falls. A celebration of life will be scheduled at a later date. Memorials may be directed to the Mason City Public Library, Hawkeye Harvest Food Bank, or Cedar Valley Hospice. Online condolences may be left for the family at MajorErickSonFuneralHome.com, and Erickson is spelled E-R-I-C-K-S-O-N. Bonnie Mae Klein was born on September 26, 1946, to parents Harry and Laverna Leith Klein. She graduated from Ventura High School in 1965. Bonnie went on to attend University of Northern Iowa, where she obtained her degree in elementary education. In 1970, she began teaching second grade at Madison Elementary. She also taught at Harding Elementary for many years until going back to UNI to obtain her master's degree in library science and then became a media specialist. She retired from teaching in 2003. In her free time, Bonnie enjoyed knitting, reading, attending performances at NIAC, drinking wine with her friends, traveling, playing in card clubs, and spending time with her grandchildren. She was the historical librarian at First United Methodist Church for many years. Bonnie is survived by her daughter, Alana Sankey, and spouse Brian. 8 grandchildren, Brenna, Ethan, Ella, Carly, Grayson, Nora, Gavin, and Eliza, and brother Ron Klein and spouse Betsy, and his children, Jason Klein and Alyssa Schofield. A stepbrother, Randy Odegaard, and his children, Christopher and Jennifer, and uncle, Roger Klein. Bonnie was preceded in death by her parents and grandparents. Alice J. Christensen. Alice J. Christensen, 95, of Belmont and formerly of Dowse, passed away on Monday, July 20th, at the Rehabilitation Center of Hampton. Graveside services for Alice Christensen will be held at 1 p.m. on Thursday, July 23rd, at Fairview Cemetery in Dowse. Those in attendance will be asked to follow social distancing guidelines and encouraged to wear a face covering. Thelma L. Descher, 1928 to 2020. Thelma Lucille Descher, 91, passed away on Monday, July 20th, at Good Shepherd Health Center in Mason City. A memorial service will be held Wednesday, July 29th, at 10:30 a.m. at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, 126 3rd Street Northeast in Mason City. Family will be celebrating Thelma's 92nd birthday. Burial will take place at Memorial Park Cemetery. Family requests that face masks are worn to both the service and the visitation. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, July 28th at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, 126 3rd Street Northeast in Mason City. Thelma was born July 29, 1928, the daughter of Robert and Nora Lindekugel Renner of Dakin, Nebraska. Thelma was a graduate of Ventura High School. Thelma worked several occupations within healthcare, mainly with elders and young children, as a nurse's aide and daycare. December 13, 1946, was the day Thelma married Harold Descher. To this union, 4 children were born. Baking and cooking from scratch were ways she could share her talent with family. Thelma loved to spend time with her grandchildren. Handwriting a Christmas letter to all her beloved friends and family was something Thelma did every year. Being a social butterfly, Thelma had the gift to gab with anyone who would listen. Playing 500 with close friends was another way Thelma spent her days. It didn't matter how much wealth Thelma had, she would give as much as possible to those less fortunate. She was a woman that gave endlessly and didn't expect anything in return. Those left to cherish memories of Thelma are her children, Linda Mao and spouse Randy, Dennis Descher, David Descher and spouse Amanda, and Doug Descher and spouse Shelley. Grandchildren, Barb Funk, Melissa Gray and spouse James, Amy Monahan and spouse Troy, Brandy Garnis and spouse Leif, Brooke Vance and spouse Dave, Randy Desher and Derek Desher. Great-grandchildren, Leanna Funk, Luke Gray, Jordan Monahan and spouse Kayla, Moose and Riley Monahan, Ava and Jacob Garnis, Nora, Wade, and Jack Vance. Great-great-grandchildren, Talia and Mira. Numerous nieces and nephews, as well as countless friends and extended family. Thelma is preceded in death by her husband, Harold, her parents, and her siblings, Norval and Chet Renner. Geraldine Jerry A. Stahl, 1940 to 2020. Geraldine Jerry A. Stahl, 79, of Mason City, passed away on Sunday, July 19th at Good Shepherd Health Center in Mason City. A visitation will be held on Thursday, July 23rd, from 4 to 7 p.m. at Major Erickson Funeral Home, 111 North Pennsylvania Avenue. Due to COVID-19, all attendees at the visitation will be required to wear a mask and follow social distancing guidelines out of respect for others. A private service will be live-streamed on Major Erickson's Facebook page starting at 1 p.m. on Friday, July 24th. In lieu of flowers, please direct donations to the family. Those donations will be used to purchase school supplies for kids in need or donated to the Trinity Lutheran Church Youth Program. Online condolences may be left for family at MajorErickSonFuneralHome.com, and Erickson is spelled E-R-I-C-K-S-O-N. Geraldine Ann Stahl was born on August 15, 1940, to parents Norman and Frances Clock Simon in Langdon, North Dakota. Jerry grew up in North Dakota and graduated from Hamden, North Dakota in 1958. She attended Minot State University and obtained a B.S. degree in elementary education in 1965. She went on to receive her M.A. from the University of Iowa and was also a National Board Certified Teacher by the National Board for Professional Teaching Standards, which Jerry was incredibly proud of. She taught in Glasgow, Montana, Carrington, North Dakota, and Rugby, North Dakota, before moving to Mason City in 1969, where she taught 4th and 5th grade at Madison Elementary for 38 years. Jerry always said she never worked a day in her life. She loved teaching with all her heart, and she never had a bad student. Jerry was united into marriage to Russ Stahl at Trinity Lutheran Church on November 24, 1972. The couple have been married for 47 years. To this union, the couple was blessed with one daughter, Greta. Among her favorite things to do was golfing with friends and family. She was very active in the church, teaching Sunday school, part of the ministry committee, and volunteered at the annual lefse-making event. She was an avid cleaner, always making sure her home was very neat and tidy. She also enjoyed the moments she spent with her grandson, whether it was playing cards, puzzles, golfing, or going on walks. Family was very important, and she cherished the moments spent with them. Jerry was incredibly loved throughout the community, and she will be dearly missed. Jerry is survived by her husband, Russ, daughter, Greta Peterson, and spouse, Terry, her favorite grandson, Damon Peterson, siblings, Dorothy, Dale, Wayne, and spouse, Helen, Kay, and Debbie, and spouse, Doug, one aunt and several nieces, nephews, great-nephews, cousins, and friends. Jerry was preceded in death by her parents, Norman and Frances Simon, a sister, Norma Jacqueline Simon, and two infant siblings. Robert E. Amason, 1946 to 2020. Robert Eugene Amason, 73, of Clear Lake, died Tuesday, July 21st at Mercy One North Iowa Hospice in Mason City. A private family graveside service will be held at Clear Lake Cemetery with Pastor Jane Harris officiating. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, a celebration of life will be held at a later date. In lieu of customary remembrances, Bob's family suggests memorial contributions to St. Peter Lutheran Church in Rockwell or Mercy One North Iowa Hospice. Bob was born December 28, 1946, the son of Glenn and Agnes Olstead Amason in Mason City. He married Patricia Boss on September 6, 1968, at Zion Lutheran Church in Clear Lake. Bob graduated from Rockwell High School. He worked as a livestock buyer for Armor Food Company in Mason City, was a mediator for the state of Iowa and farmed for over 40 years. He also served in the Iowa Air National Guard from 1966 to 1972. Bob was a Cerro Gordo County supervisor for 14 years, served on numerous boards and committees, was a member of St. Peter Lutheran Church in Rockwell and the Rockwell Lions Club. He enjoyed remaining very active in the community throughout his life. His involvement included the school board, church board, local grain elevator board, as well as the Federal Housing Administration. In his free time, he enjoyed fishing, golfing, and playing cards with friends every week. Bob is survived by his wife, Pat Amundson of Clear Lake, two children, Scott Amundson and spouse Vonnie of Clear Lake, and Jeremy Amundson and spouse Ginger of Rockwell, four grandchildren, Whitney Mixdorf and spouse John of Clear Lake, Colby Dye and spouse Lisa of Iowa City, Hattie Amundson, and Miles Amundson, four great-grandchildren, Kinsey Anderegg, Caroline Mixdorf, Cora Mixdorf, and Kale Dye, sisters-in-law Barbara Amundson and Sue Amundson, and many nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents and his brothers, Roger and Ron. Roseanne DeHolt Blanchard, 1942 to 2020. Roseanne DeHolt Blanchard, 78, of Sheffield, passed away July 21st at the Sheffield Care Center in Sheffield. She was born January 10th, 1942, to Russell and Lois Schwinger DeHolt. Roseanne was married on July 22nd, 1960, in Bradford, to Carol L. Blanchard. Roseanne loved to sew, knit, and crochet. She was a great seamstress and made a wedding dress for her daughter, Marlene, multiple different types of clothing for family and others within the community. Roseanne crocheted Christmas stockings and ornaments, afghans, scarves, and stocking caps. She also loved to garden, fish, animals, and talking to people. She is survived by one son, Michael Blanchard, and spouse Renetta of Braunfels, Texas, two daughters, Eileen Blanchard and Marlene Schinau of Mason City, sister-in-law, Berline Sutter of Columbus, Georgia, a niece, Molly Sutter and spouse Brian Bottoms of Columbus, Georgia, three grandchildren, four grandkitties, one grand puppy, and many cousins. She was preceded in death by her husband, Carol, her son, Darren, her parents, and two brothers. Private services will be held. Please send cards and memorials to 1316 North Hampshire Place, Mason City, Iowa, 50401. Dixie L. Van Every, 1933 to 2020. Dixie L. Van Every, 87, passed away peacefully Saturday, July 18th, at Kennybrook Village. Burial rites have been honored according to Dixie's wishes, with a family graveside service to be held at a later time in Mason City. Dixie Lee Van Every was born February 5th, 1933, in Mason City, daughter of Pearlie and Vivian Broadwell. She was married to Dave Van Every in 1952 and had three boys. She married Ken Hugheim in 1990. She worked for the Department of Justice, FBI, Washington, D.C., and for the Clinton Community School District, Henry Sabin School, for 26 years. She is survived by two sons, Colonel Steve Van Every and spouse Bridget of Des Moines, and Mick Van Every and spouse Pam of Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. Five grandchildren, Shane Cobine and spouse Kate of Ankeny, Ryan Van Every and spouse Julie of Des Moines, Josh Van Every and spouse Caprice of Adel, Jesse Chisuski and spouse Kevin of Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, and Melissa Van Every of Las Vegas, Nevada. 10 great-grandchildren, Gavin, Noah, Adelin, Cameron Cobine, Riley, Kimber, Jace, Jackson, Ella Van Every, and Everett Chisuski. Dixie was preceded in death by her parents and son, Terry. Her friends were very special to her. She enjoyed socializing with her golf buddies and cherished the years with those in the Clinton school system. Dixie was very proud of her family and their accomplishments. The family wishes to thank the staff of Kennybrook Village for help and care during her time there and to Suncrest Hospice Care. Memorials can be made in her name to the Benevolent Society in Clinton, or the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center, University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Clinton C. Dean, 1928 to 2020. Clinton Clifton Dean, 91, of Mason City, died Tuesday, July 20th, at Good Shepherd Health Center in Mason City. A graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, August 15th at Evergreen Cemetery in Rudd, with Reverend Sue Simmons officiating. Clinton was born November 22nd, 1928, the son of Glenn Clifton and Oral Clementine Newton Dean in Rudd. He married Gloria Maxine Green on July 28, 1949, in Charles City. She preceded him in death on March 8, 2013. A graduate of Rudd High School, Clinton worked most of his career as a farmer and mechanic. He enjoyed going for drives, traveling, spending winters in Arizona for 20 years, and watching Western movies. Later in life, he liked to read and always had a passion for farming and cars. Clinton is survived by three children: Angela Vest and spouse Michael of Camden Town, Missouri; Terry Dean and spouse Leota of Rudd; and Carla Swenson and spouse Thomas of Mason City. Two grandchildren: Justin Dean and spouse Lacey, and Aaron Trask and spouse Jason. Five great-grandchildren: Ashlyn, Isaac, and Levi Dean, and Kayla and Casey Trask, and a sister, May Hillsman and spouse Gerald. He was preceded in death by his parents and wife. Charles City considering leaving Northeast Iowa Conference after Waverly Shellrock's response to racism allegations. Following a meeting on Tuesday between the superintendents of Northeast Iowa Conference schools, the Charles City School District announced in a statement that it is evaluating whether the district will remain in the conference. The announcement comes after an investigation into allegations that fans at Waverly Shellrock High School shouted racist remarks at Charles City baseball player Jeremiah Chapman during a game on June 27th. Waverly Shellrock investigated the claims and posted a statement on the district's Facebook page on Wednesday afternoon. The district has completed an extensive investigation into reports that, at a baseball game on June 27, 2020, against the Charles City Community School District, racially motivated comments were directed toward a player for Charles City, the statement read in part. Because all individuals involved are students, federal and state law prohibit the district from releasing specific findings and actions relating to this matter, but our district is taking appropriate measures in response to this incident. Waverly Shellrock's statement also made clear that heckling and taunting will not be tolerated at sporting events, especially taunting that involves race, color, or another personal characteristic. In response to the post, Charles City sent out a statement saying that the information released lacked the clarity we need and desire. We are eager to see a clear action plan on the part of the involved school district to accept responsibility and ensure students can be kept safe from bigoted and inappropriate behaviors, the statement said. Keisha Cunnings, who is Jeremiah Chapman's mother, said she was also unsatisfied with Waverly Shellrock's response to the situation. I feel that they are not taking the situation seriously, Cunnings said. I feel that they are not trying to hold themselves accountable or their students accountable for their actions. It's basically sending the wrong message, not only to Jeremiah, but other people who are watching, that you condone this behavior. Cunnings told the Globe Gazette that Waverly Shellrock called her on July 22nd to tell her the results of the investigation. Cunnings says that she was also told that school investigation confirmed that someone called her son Colin, seemingly a reference to former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick, and could not confirm that the fans in question shouted, "Go back to the fields," though they could not confirm that this remark was racially motivated. Cunnings also said that the school said it could not confirm that anyone yelled "Trump 2020" at Chapman or that he should have been George Floyd. According to Cunnings, the school reached out and interviewed Chapman on July 15th. In a report, typically you interview the victim first, Cunnings said. Now I feel like they're victim-shaming him. That alone is frustrating to me because none of the other comments really triggered Jeremiah but the George Floyd comment. In a summary of the efforts Charles City is taking in response to the incident, the district said that it is evaluating whether it will remain in the Northeast Iowa Conference. A school district task force of coaches, students, parents, alumni, and district leadership will evaluate the school's membership with the NEIC, and if the task force decides that the district is in an unhealthy partnership, Charles City will pursue a new conference. The district outlined its expectations that the involved school district develop clear, measurable action steps to resolve racism and sportsmanship issues. Charles City also requested a one-year penalty-free moratorium for Charles City refusing to play Waverly Shellrock in the 2020-2021 school year. Furthermore, the district requested that any postseason play between the two schools occur at a neutral site. According to Charles City's statement, the district's leadership met with the executive director of the IHSAA and the IGHSAU to discuss how the incident will lead to changes. Some proposed ideas include active bystander training, increased education for all fans, postseason accountability for poor sportsmanship, and obligations to address fan behavior. Earlier this week, the New Hampton School Board discussed options for conference changes, including removing Waverly Shellrock from the conference. Since there is no way under the conference constitution to remove a school from the conference, the board instructed Superintendent Jay Jurens to pursue new conference options. "I don't think that them leaving the conference is the answer, because that is not going to fix the problem," Cunnings said. "Charles City leaving the conference, it'll help minimize it for our students, but that is still not going to fix the problem. I want to fix it. I don't want to just put a Band-Aid over it. What can we do that is solid to ensure that everyone is treated equally, no matter what? That is what I would like to see." The conference has named a sportsmanship champion since 2008, and Waverly Shellrock has finished last in the sportsmanship standings in every season where results have been released. In an email to the Globe-Gazette, Waverly Shellrock Superintendent Ed Klamfuth admitted that he was concerned with the school's annual position at the bottom of the rankings. "We need to do better and intend to engage in work that can make that happen," Klamfuth said. "That will start with school board discussions, learning, and goal setting, and move down to the student body, who we intend to have engage in work with students from other NEIC schools to set expectations." Mason City baseball falls to Waukee in sub-state final. One run, a single run, made the difference for the Mason City baseball team on Wednesday night in the Class 4A Sub-State 2 championship, as the Mohawks' season came to a heartbreaking end with a 6-5 loss to Waukee. "I told the boys afterwards, this is big boy baseball," head coach Troy Rood said. "4A CIML baseball, it was legit. This is as good as it gets. You find out what kind of competitor you are, and you have what kind of skill set you have, and how tough-minded you are. Our kids check the boxes in all those categories. We just came up one run short." The contest was a back-and-forth battle between the two CIML conference rivals. Mason City, which won the CIML Iowa this season with an 8-2 conference record, got the scoring started with a two-run homer from junior Alex Gold in the top of the first inning to give Mason City an early 2-0 lead. In the third inning, the Warriors finally got to Mason City pitcher Bradley Vaith as junior Aiden McGee clubbed a three-run homer off of a curveball to give Waukee a 3-2 advantage going into the fourth. The home run came with two out and two strikes. "Bradley executed the pitch perfectly," Rood said. "It was an outside curve, and the kid went down and golfed it over the center field fence. It was a great job by that kid, but Bradley executed a great pitch." In the fourth inning, senior Avery Millman reached base thanks to a two-out Waukee error that allowed a pair of runs to score and gave the lead back to the Mohawks at 4-3. In the fifth, the Warriors took the lead back for good as the team plated three runs in the frame to take a 6-4 lead. In the top of the seventh, Melman led off the inning with a hard-hit line drive to the left fielder for the first out. The next batter, sophomore Carter Thomas, hit a single to left field, advanced to second on a passed ball, and then stole third base on a throw back to the pitcher as Gold trotted down to first on a walk. Thomas scored on a ground ball hit by junior Ben Peterson to bring the Mohawks within one run. On the play, Gold was forced out at second base for out number two. The final batter, junior Connor Dalen, flew out to right field to end the game as the Mohawks season came to an end, one win shy of the state tournament. At the end of the game, Rood had his players gather together one last time and said goodbye to his team's trio of seniors in Melman, Vaith, and Connor Wyman. "Those three seniors have meant so much to the program," Rood said. "I know their families well, and I've known them since they were basically started walking. All three of them had such tremendous seasons." Mason City concludes the 2020 season with an overall record of 15-8. With the win, Waukee advanced to the state tournament for the 10th time in program history. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette for Thursday, July 23rd, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.
Roxanne Watson is on a mission.
Hello, how are you doing today?
She wants more people to register as organ, eye, and tissue donors.
Are you an organ donor?
Yes, I am.
Yay! Ready.
My goal is to sign up the most people in the United States.
What drives her? Roxanne's own life was saved through the gift of a heart transplant, made possible by an organ donor.
I decided that day that I was going to devote myself to the cause of organ donation and signing people up and honoring my donor by doing that.
Now she's back to health, and she's a powerful force helping to save lives every day through her work. Imagine what you can make possible by leaving behind the gift of life.
8 people can be helped with the major organs, and up to 50 people can be helped with a little bit of everything. And when you think about it that way, that you could help that many people, it's amazing. It really is.
Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.